welcome to another episode of Hashtag STR Ask. I'm Amy Hall, and with me is Greg Kokel.
Hello, Amos.
Hi, Greg.
I just got in the saddle here. We're kind of scrambling like crazy, a little bit late. And happy 25th year anniversary for Stand to Reason.
Yes, happy 25th to you.
Yeah, thank you. This is the day, May 1st, 1993, when it all started. Officially, kind of. We had some ideas before that, but that was the launch. So 25 years, a quarter of a century.
It's been a long time.
I feel a quarter of a century older now I think about it. No wonder I'm so tired.
Of course, this will air next Monday.
Yes,
so
that's right. That's
it'll be right. A week ago when people hear this.
Yeah. All right, let's see what we got.
All right, so the first question comes from Click. Is the doctrine of original sin an essential or non-essential of the Christian faith? What should you do if you find out your church believes in Pelagianism?
Well, Pelagianism entails the rejection of original sin from Pelagius, 4th century, opponent of Augustine. It's not good to be an opponent of Augustine, by the way.
Or the creeds.
And so this, you know, I would consider this an essential doctrine, a core doctrine of Christianity. It's been that way for a long time. And, excuse me, and it's if I found myself in a church that taught otherwise, I'd find another church, just to put it most simply. It's central, and so many other things are built upon that. Our essential core depravity, our lostness as a race, our unity with Adam in our fallenness. We are not just incidentally fallen. We don't just fall on our own, and we got a bunch of individual falls. We are a lost race, and David in Psalm 51 talks about, in sin my mother conceived me, you know, and so, and there's more to it than just that. Romans 5 talks about our relationship to Adam, and I know this raises questions for people that in some ways seem to be intractable, but the way we solve theological issues, we first work with the clear teaching, we build a foundation on that, and then we solve the problems that, if we're able to, that flow from the basic foundational biblical teaching, or we don't solve them because they're mysteries. But what we can't do is see something that troubles us because of the implications we think it has, even though it's taught clearly in Scripture, and then abandon it because we can't put it all together ourselves. This is, just leads to trouble. And this is why I would avoid a church that teaches Pelagianism, because not only is it an abandonment of that basic doctrine, but then we also, who knows what's going to go next based on their view.
So let me ask you a question about that, because I actually asked him more about this because I was curious what the story was with his church. And he said that his church believes, or he sent me an article, and it says that they believe in original sin, but that when Jesus died, he covered that sin such that babies are now born free of original sin. So does that change it? Is it still Pelagianism if they think Jesus has covered the original
sin?
Well,
the question there is, when we say that Jesus has covered the original sin of babies, does that mean that he has paid for the sin that is actual to them in virtue of their birth in Adam? Or are they saying that because he died, babies now no longer have any original sin and they are born with genuine innocence?
It did say that babies are born good, but they say it's because of Jesus' death on the cross.
Yeah, I basically, because of Jesus' death, then Pelagianism now, maybe, well, which would be after the cross, and Pelagius was 400 years after the cross, then that would be sound. Human beings are not born with a fallen nature in virtue of what Jesus did. I don't know why they would put that in there, frankly. Why theologically? And maybe that's an attempt to sanitize the doctrine. I don't see how it does. Mm-hmm. That's not Pelagius' view anyway, as far as I understand. We all fall on our own. And if Jesus... So what do we make then of of human sin and depravity. We are not innately depraved. We just do acts of sin. And there is no fallenness that we need to be rescued from. By the way, if babies are not born with original sin, they are not born in sin, they are not born fallen, and therefore they don't need to be regenerated. They just need to be forgiven of sins they commit.
Yeah, there are a lot of problems with it.
You know, it just occurred to me there, so yeah. Yeah, that's the part of the trouble for me is getting creative with theology. That's always a bad sign. Mm-hmm. And that appears to be what's going on here.
And the pastor openly says that they're Pelagian.
Oh, well.
So he at least says that they are Pelagian.
Yeah, well,
so
I would count that view as Pelagian.
Yeah. Okay, the next question comes from Sandra Smith. What did the disciples understand Jesus to mean in Luke 9:23, to take up our cross daily, since this was prior to the crucifixion?
Well, the imagery that Jesus drew on there was available to all the people. I'm just trying to think if we can. I'm trying to think of a metaphor from today that would make sense. We draw on all kinds of figures of speech that are meaningful, are unrelated to something in actuality in our lives. There's a theological role of the cross of Jesus, but there were crosses that people bore back then. I even hesitate to use that phrase because that's a derivative from the text, from the biblical record. So there are lots of things in our language nowadays that are part of that, you know, that are from the biblical record that work into our language, even for people who are not religious. But I'm trying to think of some kind of an illustration. Why don't I just put it this way? People understood at the time that there was crucifixions and people carried their crosses. And so the image of carrying a cross on a daily basis would have been completely meaningful to the people of that time, even though Jesus hadn't died himself on a cross, had been executed through crucifixion. It was still a standard way of you could talk about travailing as in childbirth. Man, I'm going through like trying to birth this book, right? Somebody's working on a book and it's like childbirth. It's hard work, okay? Bringing that thing forth. And so a man could make reference to this and everyone would know what he meant, even though it would never be the case that he was going to have a baby. So that's the way I think Jesus is using it there. He is simply drawing on a culturally meaningful metaphor that then became much more dramatically meaningful when Jesus bore mm-hmm. his own cross. And now we are to be like Christ. Just as Christ suffered in the flesh, we arm ourselves for the same purpose. That was 1 Peter 4.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That is an interesting observation, yeah, though, and one that never occurred to me. So that's reading attentively.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, the next question comes from Dave Michaud. Jesus is the good shepherd and lays down his life for his sheep. Pastors are called to shepherd the flock God has given them. Is there a biblical passage principle that calls fathers to pastor, physically protect their families?
Wait, there was a jump there from pastors to fathers.
So
Jesus lays down his life for his sheep.
In John 10:11, and says pastors are called to shepherd the flock.
Correct.
He gives examples of that. Is there a biblical passage slash principle that calls fathers to pastor slash physically protect their families? Is there a passage that talks about
okay. Right. Well, if there is, I mean, it would be unrelated to the prior references to shepherding and stuff like that. It just has to do with the parents or the father's responsibility for his family. And now that you mention it, I don't know that there is any passage apart from the Ephesians 5 reference of husbands loving their wives as Christ loved the church, but that's pertaining to marriage, not so much to the whole family. I don't know that there's any passage that talks about a father laying down his life for his family, okay? We have other directives that, you know, parents, fathers don't, how does it put it in Titus or First Peter, you know, don't here's my paraphrase, annoy your kids too much, you know, don't overwhelm your children with demands. So there's some guidelines there. It turns out that the Bible is largely silent compared to other things when it comes to giving directives about child rearing, caring for children. We have things in Proverbs. And I think that, and occasionally we see some things in the New Testament, but the focus is otherwise. It's not so much on that. So I think that parents are supposed to protect their children. I don't know if I need a biblical command to assert what strikes me is to be an obvious point. If I had to think about it and I did some searching, maybe I'd find some Old Testament paradigms for it. But strictly speaking, to answer the question, I don't think there is a parallel directive in the New Testament to shepherding your kids the way Jesus shepherds his flock or a pastor shepherds his church. Now, one might make the parallel that children are given into our care. We have a responsibility to raise them up. That's a shepherding kind of responsibility. Pastors are told to shepherd this way. Jesus shepherded sacrificially, and so you can make the comparison. But the question, I think, had to do with an explicit reference from the text, and this I don't know that there was.
Yeah, I guess the closest one that I can... I feel like there's something in the back of my mind that I can't think of, but probably the closest one is the one you already mentioned about the husband loving the wife as Christ loved the church, or being the head of the wife, because that would give the same idea that they are giving themselves up for them and caring for them.
Yeah, there's a sacrificial thing going on there, but that particular passage is really focused strictly, I think, on the husband-wife relationship as a picture of the relationship of Christ to the church. So children don't enter into that metaphor in that picture,
yeah,
in that
passage.
So
you wouldn't see that as applying to the whole family then?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I wouldn't want to go there because I don't think that's it isn't like the heavenly family. Like Jesus is Paul's talking about the heavenly family. And I know you're chuckling because that sounds like Mormonism, right? That's not what's going on there. There is a marriage, but there is a marriage that is meant to be a picture of Christ and the church, and that's the husband and the bride.
Right.
It is. There are no kids in that illustration.
Well, there's certainly passages talking about training up children the way they should go and that sort of thing.
Proverbs, right. And then in Deuteronomy, talking about the responsibility that parents have for training their children up in the Lord.
But right, but those aren't physically protecting them, I guess.
This is not correct. Yeah. I'm going to sneeze in just a minute.
Please hold.
Sorry, we don't have a sneeze button. There we go.
All right.
I just felt it coming. I had to warn you rather than just exploding. I scare my girls when I do that.
All right, let's go on to the next question from Jessica Myers. Mm-hmm. What is the difference between an idea that commits formal suicide and a paradox? Reading tactics and wanted clarification.
Well, formal suicide is when an explicitly self-refuting situation where a demand is made or a statement is made, and the statement falls under the purview of itself, and it cannot satisfy its own requirements. So, that's fancy schmancy. Illustration's easiest. If I said to you, I cannot speak a word of English. Well, there is a statement about what I... maybe here's a better way to put it. There are no English sentences more than three words in length. Well, that itself is an English sentence, and it has more than three words. So that sentence falls under the rule of regarding the length of English sentences, and it violates the rule itself. The rule itself violates the rule. There it's formal suicide. In that case, it cannot... we have a necessity of contradiction, and therefore what you have is an incoherent or a situation, a self-refuting situation. Sometimes you have what amounts to what I call practical suicide, where, for example, if you say, you shouldn't judge other people's behavior, Okay. Now, that is a statement in which you are actively judging the other. You are doing the thing that you're telling the other person not to do. So you are guilty of a kind of a suicide there of a practical nature. Relativism isn't itself suicidal. It isn't formally self-refuting. But when you try to assert it in certain ways, you end up with a contradictory statement. So that would be practical suicide as opposed to formal suicide. I'm not sure if I caught all of the question there or not.
So what's the difference between that and a paradox?
Well, I guess you'd have to ask the people who use the word paradox. Paradoxes are things that are two things that appear to be contradictory, but are not. But we can't resolve. We can't kind of plumb the depths of it. We should have some of our Lutheran friends in here because Lutherans talk about paradoxes a lot. I don't opt for that kind of language in most cases. Sometimes because I think a person ends up dismissing a clear contradiction by calling it a paradox. But I do think there are things that are hard to understand. The most obvious one, theologically hard to understand, the most obvious one is God's sovereignty and human freedom. And I mean in this regard, not election, sovereign grace. I mean the idea that God is sovereign in control over everything, even though human beings are making choices that are their own and that are meaningful. And how is it that God gets his stuff done without predetermining every single action? And I think that's a paradoxical kind of a situation. I don't know. I don't think it's formally contradictory, but I do think it's a kind of a mystery. It's like, boy, how does he do that? How does God know the future? You know, if God is temporal, that is, he's not in the future, and that's my view. If he participates in time, and he's not in the future, and he doesn't determine everything strictly speaking, then how is it that he knows the future? So, what grounds his knowledge of the future? This, I think, is also paradoxical. I can't answer that question. I don't know. I'm just pointing out a couple of things that seem to be non-contradictory, yet still mysterious and somewhat paradoxical.
So they're not clear. They're not clearly contradictory.
I don't see how that would be
the difference between.
That's the way I would characterize the difference, because contradictions just turn out to be contradictions, and calling contradictions paradoxes don't rescue you from the problem, it seems to me. But there are some things that they're mysterious, and they seem, maybe this is the best way to put it, they seem at odds with each other, but they aren't strictly speaking formally contradictory, even though we haven't solved out how they can be consistent. That's a paradox.
Well, thank you, Greg. We're out of time for today.
All righty.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. Send us your questions with the hashtag STRAsk on Twitter. We look forward to hearing from you. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.